Jessica. Joining me on the program are Ashley Obuljin and Jessica Von Zastro, assistant producers in VOA's Current Affairs Programming Unit, producing Press Conference USA, Encounter, and Issues in the News. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Melvin Rogers, professor of political science at Brown University in the northeastern state of Rhode Island. Appointed as Distinguished Visiting Scholar at the Kluge Center at the Library of Congress, Professor Rogers is currently in Washington, where he is exploring the political and philosophical thinking of African-American intellectuals, activists, and artists in a book-length project titled The Darkened Light of Faith, Race, Democracy, and Freedom in African-American Political Thought. Rogers is also the author of The Undiscovered Dewey, Religion, Mortality, and the Ethos of Democracy, and is co-editor of Oxford University Press New Histories of Philosophy series. In his articles, which have appeared in media outlets such as the Boston Review, Public Seminar, and The Atlantic, Professor Rogers largely focuses on pragmatist and educational reform proponent John Dewey's philosophy and how it relates to Black activism, white nationalist activity, and the Trump administration. He also touches on works from African-American authors such as Ta-Nehisi Coates and James Baldwin, sometimes concurring with, but also challenging, their arguments. On this edition of the program, we'll talk with Professor Rogers about his current research at the Kluge Center and elicit his analysis of the relative strength or fragility of democratic institutions in America as we see a rise in anti-immigrant, racist, and anti-Semitic sentiment. Professor Melvin Rogers, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me here.
And I'm delighted to welcome my colleagues Ashley Obuljin and Jessica Von Zastro.
We're glad to be here. Thanks for having us.
Well, Professor, I'd like you to talk about your research at the Kluge Center, your ongoing book-length project called The Darkened Light of Faith, Race, Democracy, and Freedom in African-American Political Thought. Tell us about some of the thinkers and activists whose thinking and philosophy you're studying.
So it's a big book project, and it's a book project that is trying to make sense of the ways in which African-Americans have, over the course of the U.S. history, have appealed to the American polity. They have appealed to the American polity for inclusion. They have appealed to the American polity to show care and concern for them. And they have done that amid the sort of constant slews of no's that have come back to them. And so the question for me is, how must they understand democracy so as to legitimize or make sense of the appeals that they're making to their fellows? And so the book is an attempt to explore the answer to that question.
And who are some of the thinkers you're focusing on?
Some of the more prominent names that the public at large will likely be familiar with include Frederick Douglass, and it includes W.E.B. Du Bois, and it includes Martin Luther King Jr. But there are lesser known but actually significant figures that the public will not likely be aware of, like David Walker, the early 19th century abolitionist who published an incendiary pamphlet in 1829. There are other figures, Mariah Stewart of the same period. There's Alain Locke of the 1920s. There's James Baldwin of the 60s and 70s. So these are some of the figures that are significant and central to the book.
I want to go back to your previous publication about John Dewey. Mm-hmm. What is it about John Dewey's philosophy that resonates with you, particularly in the current political context?
So John Dewey is an American philosopher. He was born 1859 and he died in 1952. And he's most known for his philosophy of education. But Dewey is actually also very important for helping us to think about democracy. And so the reason why Dewey is important in these current times is because he sort of thinks about democracy as not just simply being about political and legal institutions, but also democracy is about a set of habits, dispositions, and sensibilities that serve as the foundation for those institutions. And so if you don't have a democratic culture, it becomes very difficult, as Dewey sees it, to sustain the democratic institutions.
Well, that raises quite a number of questions, but let me turn to my colleague, Jessica Von Zastro, for a question.
So one of the things that I found interesting about your work is looking at the fragility of democracy. We always think of democracy as having this fundamental structure that is unable to be broken. But also recently, we have seen this swing from left to right on a pendulum of different ideologies. And how do you think that this swing from different kind of populist movements in the United States might affect the foundation of democracy here in America?
So one of the interesting things about the sort of story of American history, particularly the American framers, is that part of what they imagined was that virtue is often in short supply. Character often fails us. And so we need a way to compensate for the absence of virtue. And the way they imagined doing that was through a set of institutional structures that could endure the ebb and flow of character, that can endure the vices that we often display and could be ennobled at various points by the virtues we come to display. But although virtue for them was in short supply, and they believed that, they did not believe that a political society such as ours, a Republican society, could get on about the business of surviving in the absence of virtue, in the absence of character. And so my own sense is that we have spent a lot of time thinking about our institutional structures, thinking about the legal infrastructure of society, and we have spent less time talking about what does it mean to have the requisite virtues to realize a free and self-governing society and to ensure that it can maintain itself over time.
Let's now turn to Ashley for a question.
Your previous book, The Undiscovered Dewey, was published in 2008. Mm-hmm. With all that's changed since then, what's different about your current project?
So the current project in some ways continues the theme of the first project. The first project was really about defending John Dewey's interest in what it means to be a responsive democratic citizen. What does it mean to respond to the demands of your fellows? And what does it mean to respond to the demands of your fellows in an environment where there is no certainty that they will comport themselves in the right way? So if there's any group of individuals that have been most concerned historically about the virtues and the responsiveness of the society as African Americans in their quest to achieve freedom and equality.
So what do you think his take would be, that is Dewey, on today's politically charged environment, the racial tensions, the denigration of immigrants, the recent calls we've heard from President Trump about even four minority members of Congress saying because they disagree with him that they should go back to where they came from, even though they are U.S. citizens and they are women of color. One is an immigrant from Somalia who became a naturalized citizen at the age of 17. How would he respond?
Well, right, you know, I think at this present moment, John Dewey is rolling over in his grave. You know, the signature text to consider is Freedom and Culture of 1939. And this was a book, as Dewey was watching the ascendancy of totalitarianism, this is a book that sought to remind Americans that a democratic society is not secured on its own. It does not run on its own inertia. And what I think he would be concerned about is the ways in which the current administration is putting into public circulation and normalizing a set of habits. The current administration essentially is saying that cruelty is the norm, right? That disregard is the norm, that hate is the norm, and that those three elements are actually necessary if America is going to remain a world power. It's necessary if America is going to achieve a greatness that this administration believes wrongly that we have somehow lost.
How worried are you that the Trump administration, Mr. Trump in particular, is accentuating the heretofore more marginalized voices of white supremacists, militias, people with anti-immigrant sentiment? I mean, we know that this is part of our history, obviously. Mm-hmm. These voices exist, but they have heretofore been more marginalized or tamped down. And we have tried, our leaders have tried to capitalize on our better angels, but we're seeing the opposite, it appears, to many. And I wonder how you think we can recover from this. What would it take?
So there's two questions here. The first is sort of how I feel about this. I mean, I'm deeply concerned. These are moments where the language to describe one's feelings escape you. Because for whatever we like to say, regardless of whether or not we voted for the current president or not, the president speaks in our name and he acts in our name. And so we bear the stamp and the stain of what he does. So how do we respond to this? And we see it in various places where protests are cropping up that are emerging all around this country, whether it's in response to ICE or whether it's in response to some shenanigans that have just taken place in right here in D.C. in the White House. So we see it. One of the things that we have to do is to reject the claim that somehow this administration and those that he represents have a lock on the traditions that we find ourselves living. White supremacy, nativism, patriarchy, that's part of our tradition. It is. But that's not all that's a part of our tradition. And so what we need to do, and we see protesters doing this now, are appealing to the best of our traditions and putting it in the service of their response to this administration. We see scholars, academics, lay intellectuals attempting to do the same in print to give articulation to a new future.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Professor Melvin Rogers, political science professor at Brown University in the state of Rhode Island and a distinguished visiting scholar at the Kluge Center at the Library of Congress. He's the author of The Undiscovered Dewey, Religion, Morality, and the Ethos of Democracy. I'm Carol Castiel, along with assistant producers Ashley Obuljan and Jessica Von Zastro. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Well, here's a shout out to valued listener Nasir Ahmad from Afghanistan. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to PCUSA@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our conversation with Professor Melvin Rogers. Let me turn to Jessica for a question.
When we talk about the values of America, America was founded on principles such as those outlined in the Bill of Rights, and the First Amendment covers specific freedoms, one of those being the freedom of speech. With the rise of white supremacy in America again, with hate speech online, can you talk a little bit about what the First Amendment's guarantee of freedom to speech means right now in 2019?
You know, the First Amendment is really the sort of culmination of a concern about the sort of diversity of religious groups and the ability for religious groups to sort of speak up and out and against without fear of persecution. You know, in our current moment, one of the things that we have to realize is that the First Amendment provides a basic guarantee, but by itself, it cannot do all of the work that we want it to do, by which I mean we also sort of expect that people will engage in a kind of self-censorship, that they will come to see that the sort of etiquette of the discourse that they're engaging in is inappropriate. It is a violation of the sort of moral standing of the people about whom you're speaking. This is what the white supremacists are engaged in, right? They want to deny your moral standing. So it is true that the First Amendment provides a protection, but the hope, or at least we like to hope, is that the culture of a democratic society will have educated us in such a way that we will come to see that certain kinds of discourse, certain ways of talking, just violate moral standards that we're committed to. Not committed to because they were enshrined in an amendment, but committed to because they form the foundation of who we take ourselves to be.
You said we would hope that we would have those values, but recently we've seen a lot of hate speech going around, especially in 2017 with the Charlottesville incident, and you wrote an article about that. So what's your take on where we go from there?
My sense is that the sort of way to sort of respond to those who are engaged in hurtful and incendiary speech is really to increase the loudness of those who are speaking in the service of justice and equal standing, right? And to speak in such a way that the other voices no longer have a hold on us. that in truth they really are speaking to an empty room. That's what one wants to create. But of course, it becomes very difficult when the person occupying the highest office of the land tells you that this kind of discourse is actually permissible.
Well, speaking of Charlottesville, you did write an article in the aftermath of that white supremacist rally in which there were members of Ku Klux Klan and other bigots who were, of course, trying to tamp down the protesters who wanted to see the dismantling of some Confederate statues,
yes.
Right? And, of course, a woman died, and it was a horrific moment. And you wrote White Identity and Terror in America, thinking about the events of Charlottesville.
Mm-hmm.
And you said this was a very dangerous moment, and that for so long, those on the left have been criticized by the right for talking and speaking in the language of identity. And then you say identity talk has typically been deployed by the left to highlight those who have been excluded, marginalized, and dominated. But you also say that the right is using identity talk, and it's very different. How do you distinguish between the two? What's different about the so-called identity talk from the left and then from the right?
For me, the basic cut is inclusion and exclusion. That if we look at the history of the United States, and when we look at the abolitionist movement, and we look at the women's rights movement, and we look at the civil rights movement, and we look at the gay rights movement, whenever the argument from the left in the service of identity politics has emerged, it has often emerged because there has been constitutive fundamental exclusions. So the criticism has been to recognize who I am, and to treat who I am as worthy of respect and dignity. When those on the right deploy arguments in defense of the nation or in the defense of whiteness, it is often tied up and premised on a desire to exclude. The president's most recent comment to the squad, his recent comment is basically this: you're in my home, because my home is a home that's dominated by white people. That's what America is in his mind. And so when you come in my home, how dare you comport yourself in this way? How dare you to begin to tell me how the furniture should be, where the furniture should be located, and how people in my home should be treated? So since you don't like my home, go back to yours. This is the way he thinks about it.
But their home is here.
Exactly.
And so this is a denial of the fact that our country is becoming more and more multicultural, more diverse, more brown demographically. We're mm-hmm. changing. And that should be seen as to the good.
But the point is, to wrap back to the question, is that when identity is deployed from the right, it's often deployed to shut down borders, to close doors, to speak in the name of exclusion rather than in the name of inclusion.
So that leads me to ask you, what are they afraid of? I mean, this is a big country. It's not as if we're full. The term that Mr. Trump used, mm-hmm. that we don't have enough room for other people, this is unfortunate language. I mean, we have a big country geographically and metaphorically for lots of people, and that is why we are so creative and seen as the leading power in the world. There's room for everyone. Why are they so insecure?
I mean, what are power holders always afraid of? Losing their power. And power doesn't necessarily mean ability to maneuver the levers in Washington, D.C., although it includes that. There's power that attends to one's very identity as a white person. I won't use the language that is very sort of common today, privilege. But one of the things that we have to acknowledge is that the sort of skin that one has and the color of that skin affords some of us more opportunities than others. It is seen in a positive light rather than a negative light. This is the way whiteness functions. And this is what one is afraid of, that if I become just one minority among others, then all of a sudden my power has disappeared. I no longer have standing.
Back to another article you wrote, Keeping the Faith. You were writing about Ta-Nehisi Coates' latest book, We Were 8 Years in Power, An American Tragedy. He was referring, of course, to Barack Obama. And he, of course, felt that this is still a country, notwithstanding its diversity and progress vis-a-vis African Americans and other minorities, that this perhaps was just an anomaly. Now we're back. We have a backlash with President Trump mm-hmm. and the rise of white supremacy, the mm-hmm. rejection of all that Mr. Obama stood for. But you were critical of Coates.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about why. Perhaps he has a point.
So Ta-Nehisi Coates, I think, is a brilliant journalist. I think that he is very thoughtful in the criticisms that he advances about the United States. But I think that there is slippage in how he advances his criticism. So his criticism of the United States, the sort of primacy of white supremacy, the blip that the Obama administration represented, and the normalcy that Trump actually represents in terms of understanding the American polity, my sense is that this is only one part of the story. So my criticism of Coates is really, let's complicate the story. Let's not concede the ground. Let's acknowledge that the story of American moral and political life has always been a story of contestation, a fight over what this thing we call America is and who comprises it, right? And my sense is that when you tell that broader story, Black and brown people are now not standing outside the door, banging to get in. They stand inside, arguing and fighting over how this place will be constituted. So that's my criticism of Coates, even as I acknowledge and will continue to acknowledge that I think he's brilliant. I think his voice is necessary.
Exactly. He just has a more fatalistic, pessimistic view, and you have a more hopeful one, which is really laudable.
I don't think that we have any other choice.
Ashley, I would like to ask you a question.
So going off of that, since Trump was elected, with everything that's happened, how have you maintained that optimism?
So I'm not an optimist. I don't believe that all is tended in the right direction. I don't think that all is right in the world. I'm a faith holder. And the one thing about faith holders is that they are often trying to offer up a vision that is at odds with the way in which the society to which they belong is currently organized. And the faith holder is always prepared for the possibility that the people to whom he or she is speaking will say no. We're unpersuaded. And that utterance, no, we're unpersuaded, does not in any way undercut the sort of power or the commitment that one has to the vision that they're offering up. It makes it more challenging, right? But this is one of the things about the faith holders. They are able to endure the sort of failures, the fragility, and the short-sightedness of one's fellows, even as they're attempting to try to point the way to distant and better shores.
So what is the role that faith can and should play in politics, especially at this moment of political struggle and, I would argue, constitutional crisis?
It seems to me that faith is actually central, I would even say intrinsic, to political life. And why is that the case? It is because, as I just said a moment ago, you're attempting to offer up a vision that is at odds with the way society is organized and attempting to persuade your fellows that they can find a home in this vision. Yes? And it seems to me that in political life, right, we are always dealing with the possibility that our fellows will say no. So there are big and small things that citizens are trying to achieve. And some of the small things don't necessarily touch the scent of their identity. But then there are big things. Right? Immigration, abortion, whether or not people will have basic civil liberties, right? It seems to me that what sort of steals one during those moments is faith. So the issue is not whether you will be a faith holder or not. The real issue is what kind of faith will you hold?
And you're not talking about a particular religion,
no,
obviously.
No. I mean, this is why I framed it as a vision that is at odds with the way in which society is organized, right? And there are positive and negative faith, right, visions, right? There are some faith holders that actually we don't want to have their vision realized. Those on the right are defenders with deep and profound conviction of their defenders of a certain kind of vision, and they have faith that it could be realized through the current occupant of the White House, right? And we need to articulate coherently, intensely, and with conviction our own alternative vision.
Before I turn to my colleague, I just wanted to follow up briefly. Mm-hmm. We're seeing a co-optation of the Republican Party by Mr. Trump, a party that used to stand for free trade, for the promotion of democracy, and other ideals that they seem to be turning on their head. I just wonder, we're coming up on a presidential election. How can those who want to challenge the rhetoric of the current GOP and the occupant in the White House, how can they do that when they are really drowning out so many voices and in a way, distorting the truth on a daily basis. And then we have, of course, social media, disinformation from foreign adversaries, mm-hmm. like the Russians, who are all too anxious to really, you know, sow divisions and capitalize on these divisions. So it's extremely difficult.
In my estimation, this is one of the problems in trying to manage the left that is itself internally diverse, portions of which are fighting for a multiracial, multicultural democracy. And so the aim is to figure out how to wield a vision in which that very diversity can find a home in. And this is actually one of the things that the Republicans have going for them. But in a realm of homogeneity, it becomes easier to unify your base. Trump understands that. He understands that very clearly. And he understands that part of the means or the mechanism by which you unify your base is literally to become a lightning rod for them. And, you know, this is why Trump often appears to be larger than life. This is why he often defies all of the traditional rules of politics, because he stands outside of the traditional rules. He is the charismatic leader, not in terms of what he says, he's bumbling about, but in the ways in which he harnesses this vision and crystallizes it through himself. And the left needs to figure out a way to do something like this. Who will be our lightning rod? Who will find a way to articulate a message that can pull this diversity together in a way that is both unified and nonetheless still diverse? I think, you know, a number of the presidential, the hopefuls on the Democratic side, I think some of them understand this, that it is about specific strategic policies that one puts forward, but we also know it's about getting the left to fall in love with a story about itself. Because when we're in love with a story about ourselves, in the same way when we're in love with a person, we'll fight for them, we'll defend them to the end, and we'll go to the edges of the earth for them.
You talked about who could be the lightning rod for the left. Do you have an idea of who that could be?
I have no idea. I am a fan of Elizabeth Warren, but I ultimately have no idea.
Well, as we close, Professor Rogers, just final words with respect to how your research is going here at the Kluge Center, and if you're enjoying your stay, et cetera. And once again, you know, how much progress you're making on your new project.
So the Kluge Center is absolutely wonderful. It is amazing to work in this extraordinary institution that is the Library of Congress, and to work on these thinkers in this space. And the book is coming along.
It's an interesting title, The Darkened Light of Faith.
Yes.
So yes. Dark and light.
Because we need to find a way to track both the sort of commitment of the faith holders, but the way in which that commitment is tempered. And so the faith holders are not these activists that are caught in headlights. They're not these activists that and thinkers that are optimistic. They are a group of figures who are struggling to make this society better, all the while knowing the failure is around the corner. And one still has to go on in light of that failure. And that is what tempers their light. That is what darkens it.
Professor Melvin Rogers is a distinguished visiting scholar at the Kluge Center at the Library of Congress. He also teaches political science at Brown University in the state of Rhode Island. Professor Rogers, thanks for coming in and for sharing so much from your research and insights.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been great.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Kim Lewis for booking our guest. Our engineer was Thomas Blondet. Joining me on the program were assistant producers Ashley Obuljan and Jessica Von Zastro. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
This is VOA News. I'm David Berg. Britain's Foreign Secretary Jeremy Hunt says his nation is trying to figure out a diplomatic solution after Iranian authorities seized two tankers in the Strait of Hormuz Friday, intensifying tensions in the strategic waterway. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn reports one of those ships has